Welcome to Theatre Voice. I'm Judy Herman, and I'm really delighted today to be with Tanika Gupta. Although we're at Theatre Royal Stratford East, where Tanika's actually rehearsing one of her own plays, which is called Love and Stuff and is firmly set now, we're actually going to talk about A Midsummer Night's Dream, which is Emma Rice's first production as artistic director at Shakespeare's Globe. But Tanika has been playing a role that Shakespeare might have been quite surprised by. She is Shakespeare's dramaturge, which it's very trendy to have a dramaturge now, but Shakespeare, whether he knew he needed one or not, for this one he does. And this is a production, Tanika, that, like your Love and Stuff, actually does take place. But not just in the present day, but right there on Bankside.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I have to say, I've never actually been a dramaturg before, and I've always been deeply suspicious of them. So it was quite extraordinary to actually be acting in the role for the first time. But I have actually worked with Emma Rice before on a couple of productions. One was Wawa Girls, which was a Bollywood musical, which was Sadler's Wells. And the other, which was a much bigger production, was The Empress at the RSC, which I wrote and she directed in 2013 at the Swan. So we've always been looking for ways of working together again. And when she got the job at the Globe, in fact, one of the first things she said to me was, I want to do A Midsummer Night's Dream, will you help me with it? So that was different from saying, will you dramaturg it? So, I mean, obviously I'm delighted to work with Emma, but really as a dramaturg, I don't feel like I had a huge amount to do because she wanted some cuts and she was very clear about wanting to change the sex of Helena to a man. So those were all Emma's ideas, and it was just about making a few updates of the script. So really what I'd seem to do much more of was writing lyrics to songs.
Yes, well, there are updates, though. I mean, been through, you know, you think you know Midsummer Night's Dream, so I've been through the script you very kindly sent me with a coarse tooth comb, maybe not so much a fine one. So, and, it, of course, the moment you change gender, quite a lot of things happen, and the moment you bring something into the present, quite a lot of things happen too. Mm. So let's get that location. It is firmly on Bankside, and there's a whole lot of talk in the play about you'll know the man by the weeds of Athens he doth wear, and we've got Hoxton, and yes. Hoxton hipster. The male lovers become Hoxton hipsters, which I love.
Yeah, so at one point I think we were talking about actually setting it in a Greek restaurant called the Athenian. and then we thought, actually, let's just set it in the present and let's just make Athens into London. Because actually one of the things that I'm really delighted that Emma's done is that she's made it a very diverse cast. And although without like banging the drum, the fact that a lot of the actors in the play are black or Asian immediately gave it a modernity, I think. And the fact that the Globe Theatre is on Bankside, we just thought, actually, let's just make it up to date. So really, when you're going through the script and you're looking at every time they say Athens, you put Hoxton in, and knowing what Hoxton is like, that actually it's the land of hipsters, it seemed to work very well. And every now and then I did turn to Emma and go, are we allowed to do this with Shakespeare? I don't want to get shouted at. And she kept looking at me and saying, I'm not sure, can we? But in the end, we did. And I'm really, really pleased we kind of held out, because I think, to be honest, very little has changed. It is just about those little moments where you step out of the script, or you step out of the text, or you change the name of the place, or you change the name of the character even.
Well, of course, I mean, obviously, they do go on about Athens, but Shakespeare hadn't been to Athens as far as we know, and I think it was just somewhere vaguely exotic, but it feels like London, doesn't it? Anyway.
Yeah, absolutely. A Midsummer Night's Dream is clearly, you know, it's a really mad story as well, and extremely fun. So we just thought we'd have a lot of fun with it. And I think that knowing who the actors were going to be whilst I was I like to call it bashing the bard.
Yeah, I like it. Goodness me. Yeah.
It was very, it just was very enjoyable, because of course we all know Midsummer Night's Dream, even if we don't know Shakespeare, it's one of those plays. And I absolutely am no expert on Shakespeare. Shakespeare, but I did really kind of, whilst I was going through it again and again and again, looking at the text, I did really fall in love with them all over again. And we had, I had the most wonderful day where I went to Bristol with Emma, and we sat together and we literally just read the whole play out together, just the two of us reading out all the parts. I mean, you know, I'm sure anybody listening to it would have been screaming the way that I mangled his verse, but it was a way of actually, I mean, it's spoken, isn't it? So to actually hear it out loud and hear yourself say it out loud is the way to hear a play. And certainly that's what I would do with my own plays. I read them out loud to myself. So we could see exactly where it worked and where we need to think about it. The other thing that we were talking about a lot was the mechanicals. And so, again, this is all Emma's idea, which was to make the mechanicals all women and that they would be workers at the Globe. Because the Globe runs on the generosity of an enormous amount of volunteers who will wear those T-shirts, we thought, how brilliant to include them. And at one point, I thought she was actually going to use the real-life people who work there, but then she got actors in. But, yeah, so, again, you know, Boo and Snout, and they all changed their names to women, and it was women of the Globe as opposed to the mechanicals as they are in Shakespeare's original play. But it's still the same exactly the same characters doing the same things.
Yeah, I know, but the fact that they're women and they're now, and let's just run through what's on these wonderful things. So if anyone remembers Peter Quince, magnificently that becomes Rita Quince, which just so works. I mean, you know what I mean? Rita's just such a now sort of name and sort of almost a comedy name.
Yes.
You know, after educating Rita and all that, you know, it's out there, isn't it? The bottom, the health and safety officer. Luckily, you weren't trying to scan because it's not in verse most of the time.
Bottom had to stay as Nick Bottom, as the man, because obviously he's that's the whole thing. He is very much in charge. Well, not in charge. He's with all these women admirers who are the Globe workers. So that was very much that was there right from the beginning, and wasn't very difficult to choose change. I think, in fact, what ended up happening quite a few times is where I had changed the script, the actors then came in and changed it again. So that because Emma works with a lot of devising, she doesn't necessarily always follow what the writer says. So there was this thing where I'd go into rehearsal and I'd see that she changed it. And I go, why have you changed that? And she said, oh, we thought that would be a better idea. So there would be quite a lot of... but that's the spirit of it. You know,
absolutely.
If that was my own script, then it would be a different matter. But it's very much about bringing to fore the talents of the specific actors and what they brought to the part. So, you know, Oberon was very different from Titania, etc. And I think one of the things that we looked at was the whole thing of Hippolyta and who she was. And we both felt quite disturbed by this line in the play right at the beginning, which is, I wooed thee with my sword. And... both Emma and I looked at each other. What the hell does that mean? Doesn't that mean I raped you, or that I won you over through battle?
Well, it does mean that, because they do have a battle. Yeah.
Yes. Well, exactly. So, how do we bring Hippolyta round, and how do we justify this? So we actually cut that line out. I wooed thee with my sword, and right at the end, when the mechanicals are doing their play, it's only Theseus that talks. I think all the women just shut up. They don't say anything. So that was where I put the most changes, where I just swapped around so that it was actually Hippolyta who said quite a lot of the words, cut out a lot of the men. So Lysandra and Demetrius talking, I cut them out and I put in the women instead. And those are where the switcheroos happened. Mm. Then, of course, we get into rehearsal and the chaplain, Theseus,
Zubin Vala,
comes into rehearsals and said, that's the most important line, you can't cut that out. So it went back in. And actually what was really interesting is that Meow Meow, who was playing Hippolyta, kind of made her role into a sort of quite sort of reluctant bride. Mm.
So it worked.
So it actually worked. You felt that she had been taken by force. So there are lots of nuances there to do with women, not just the Globe women, but but Hippolyta as well, and her relationship to Theseus. So those were kind of thought through. But I think mostly as a dramaturg, what I seem to have been doing is, apart from writing the lyrics, was being a sounding board for Emma at the beginning of the process, before anybody else was in there, before any of the actors got in there. And once the actors got in there and they were in rehearsal room, I actually left them alone. I just thought, actually, this is a very different process to the one that I'm used to, and I cannot sit here getting sort of possessive about the text. A, it's not my text, and B, it's about discovering the piece anew, and they need to do that.
Well, no, don't. Let's play down your role, because I think I detect your hand from time to time. And we will come to the songs, obviously, but whilst we're on gender, I mean, Robin Starveling's great, because Robin is a girl's name, but I love aromatherapist instead of Taylor. I mean, you have had fun. Is it you and Emma, or what? And Boo Snout. I love the idea of Boo Snout, single mother of five. And Snug the Cleaner is probably my favourite, because it has got the same rhythm. I think when they've got the same rhythm, they're wonderful. But even so, I love aromatherapy.
I have a feeling that I came up with a couple of them, and they came up with a couple of them. I think I had them doing stage management and stuff like that. But then actually, they were changed to the cleaner and the aromatherapist. But yes, it gets to the point where you can't remember which bits you did and which bits you didn't. But certainly all the changes to the sex and the all those sort of things I did do. And even, you know, in Puck's talking about women of the globe who work there, that I did actually work with the verse. And so that was quite hard, actually, trying to mimic the iambic pentameter when I'm actually not a poet at all, you know.
Yeah, but I think you're probably right in them and in a very natural way anyway. Yes. But obviously, if you're going, well, we'll come on to the most important sex change in a moment, which is Helena to Helenus, which I absolutely adored. But obviously that brings lots of moments where you can't say maid, you've got to say man or whatever, that's easy. Yeah. But there's the odd bit of rhyme that you've got to sort out and things like that. But just before we leave the mechanicals, reluctantly, because I loved Nick and his harem, Nick Bottom. And
yes.
He's the most attractive Bottom I've ever seen. I would love to have been part of his harem. So that was brilliant. And who wrote the whole of the opening scene then, when they come on and they do this prologue, preamble, about starting with Ophir and Muse of Fire, but going into health and safety demonstration?
That was them. That's very much a sort of knee-high devised introduction. In fact, when I went to the rehearsals and saw that for the first time, I was quite surprised, but I loved it. I did love it.
And, it's gorgeous.
But it's that sort of thing when you go, as a writer, you go into rehearsals and you watch things and you give notes and you go, that bit doesn't work, and cut that, and you know, all that sort of stuff, which is really important, because you're the sort of objective eyes in many respects.
Yeah. Well, so now we can move on to Helenus. Now we've talked quite a lot about the mechanicals, but I sort of read it in the programme, wondered about it, and it's just made such sense of the whole play. I'm not saying you should always do that, but the idea that, you know, that Hermia felt safe with this nice homosexual bloke, he's completely gorgeous. Hang on, that's played by Ankur Bahi. I hope I pronounced that correctly.
Yeah, so basically Ankur is an actor, again, that we worked with in The Empress. And he is a dancer. He's a classically trained Indian dancer.
Oh, he moves beautifully.
And he is just a lovely person to work with. So when we were talking about changing Helena to Helenus, one of the things that Emma was always talking about was how badly Lysander treats Hermia, and how badly Demetrius treats Helena in the original, and so it softens it in a way if it's about a man who's not able to deal with his own homosexuality. And so once we'd come up with the decision to change Helena to Helenus, which is again Emma Rice's idea, it did kind of fit in really well. It didn't seem to... I was a bit worried at one point. I thought, how are we going to change all this? But actually, it just seamlessly went in. And so really, it was all about, you know, when they talk about maid, you change it to lover. And that all the stuff about Demetrius trying to run away from what he really is in the forest. And I remember there's a scene in the middle where Helenus is chasing after Demetrius, and he's absolutely doesn't want anything to do with him, keeps saying, go away, go away. It gets quite violent. And in a way, it works really well when it's two men. Mm. I thought it worked seamlessly, actually, and I thought that in a way it worked even better than the original. Yeah. Well, but it's really about updating it to the modern times. And I think what's really interesting is it's brought in a huge young audience who kind of relate to it immediately. Because right at the beginning of the play, when Aegeus is having a go, Aegeus, that is Hermia's father, is having a go at Lysander for running off with Hermia, making love to her, whatever. And Demetrius is, you know, he's accused of having had a relationship with Helenus. And then Helenus, as a man, stands up in the audience. Everybody in the audience sort of, there's a sort of knowing laughter, which is a laughter also of recognition. It's not of like, oh my God, what have they done? And it works really well. So the actor playing him is just stunning. So. Yeah.
Well, that's one of the reasons it works. And but the idea that the Demetrius is sort of uncertain of his own sexuality.
Yes.
And then, of course, there's that line, well, they were betrothed. And, of course, now that
yes.
works because
yes.
we do have same-sex weddings.
Yes, yes.
It works perfectly. And the whole thing just really,
yeah.
really worked. And suddenly it made sense. I know you did, there is a cut, there's a famous speech, because, anyway, it's famous because lots of girls do it for an audition,
yes,
don't
yeah.
they? The one about Helena is
yeah.
saying how she's been betrayed by Hermia, who's betrayed their sex. So obviously
yes,
bits
yes.
of that had to go
yeah.
because, and you've got this thing that at school you do have a best friend, so if you're in a mixed sex school, then obviously, so Hermia and Helenus have been best friends at school, and so she feels betrayed because of her best mate, her confidant, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it works really well. I mean, you know, how many of us straight women have best mate gay men? So, I mean, you know,
yeah, exactly.
well into adulthood. So it just felt very natural. And even the fact that there's one point where all three of the men start putting lip salve on. They share a pot of lip salve.
Yeah.
And it's just that whole thing of metrosexuality
yes.
and mixing
yes.
up. Mixing up the whole idea of who you should end up with, and that it's not a surprise that it's just totally taken for granted. Even when Theseus says at the beginning, oh yes, I had heard that there was a thing between Demetrius and Helenus. Yes, that's true. And it's like, it just works beautifully well. I think the other thing that is quite interesting for me was the whole business of the Indian child.
Mm.
The changeling, as they call it.
Yes, a changeling child
that
Titania and Oberon are fighting over.
Yes, and so that was, again, another sort of image that we kept thinking of well, apart from anything else, we kept thinking, why would Oberon want this baby? That's
yes,
really
it was. It's always worried me,
yeah.
you know. Anyway.
yes.
Because
what's that all about?
Yeah, yes, exactly.
He says he wants him for his henchman. And
yes, so he's tiny.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah,
it's obviously
yeah.
quite a new, you know,
yeah.
you've got a puppet, but he's
yeah.
obviously a toddler or a three-year-old. And, you know, in these days when we worry about, child sex abuse, and,
yes.
you know, and these paedophile rings. Well, it makes
yes.
Oberon sound like a sort of very paedophile.
Yes, I know, and it did worry us. But yes, we didn't want to do about anything about paedophilia. So we, but although it was something that had come up, but more than anything else, there is this whole thing in Indian mythology, which is the whole of Mahabharata. And even the Ramayana, which is when anyone needs to find themselves, they go off into the forest.
Mm.
They're often exiled into the forest, and magical things happen in the forest. So for me, this felt very kind of a comfortable world, you know. Yes, you do go to the forest to find yourself, and strange things happen. And I love the whole thing about the Indian changeling, because when I reread Midsummer Night's Dream for this, I was thinking, oh my goodness me, you know, Shakespeare's talking about the land of spices and this
yeah.
this votaress of the order. You know, this is a whole world that we don't really investigate enough.
Mm.
So hence, it felt really lovely that Helenus was played by an Indian
yes.
Indian man. I don't know why, it just felt very natural
yes.
and normal to
yeah.
me. But also that the whole thing of the forest and the magic of it felt very you know, resonant.
Well, what's so lovely is that you're saying it works across cultures and, and time, really, and space, which I think, to me, that's what Shakespeare's always done. I mean, I did actually see there was at the Roundhouse a few years ago, there was a Midsummer Night's Dream entirely set in India.
Oh,
which,
right,
I don't know if you saw it, was incredibly good, actually.
Yes,
I love
it.
I can't remember whose it was, but it was good.
Yes,
And obviously, it transplants
it
anywhere.
It wasn't Tim Supple, was
I think it might have been, actually.
Yeah.
Well, I liked it, I have to say that.
Yeah.
But, you know, as you say, that speech, his mother was a votaress of my order.
Yes.
I always see that beach. Mm. I always see the pregnant woman, you know, and she's in a sari or whatever, as you say, and she's got, and she's copying the sails of the boats going by because she's got her swollen belly from her pregnancy that looks like a sail with wind in it. I mean, it's beautiful pictures.
Mm.
And, yeah, I think that is a lovely central image that you've taken. You know, that it's on this shore.
It's interesting with all these kind of ideas because you sit and talk and often they don't really... It's not that they're necessarily massive big things in the production, but you kind of need them... in there, in your psyche, in your subconscious, before you start tackling it, because I think it does come out in a different way.
Well, whilst we're on the subject of Titania, which we kind of are, about Meow Meow. Now, if I were to suddenly go for same-sex relationships, she'd be the one who would tempt me, but I don't think
you'd be the only one.
What an amazing woman. I mean, but what I loved about her was, quite apart from her brilliant physicality and her legs that go up to there, as the saying goes, and the brilliant way she moves because of the background that she comes from as a cabaret performer, I have not seen or heard a Titania speak the verse as well as that for as long as I can remember. It's complete. She's very, very natural. She's very commanding.
Yes.
She's in charge. She is a fairy queen.
Mm.
And I just thought she was the best Titania ever because she bought she had everything, you know, the sexuality.
Mm.
And
Well, again, Meow Meow is someone that Emma has worked with a lot in the past. I think she did Umbrellas of Cherbourg with her. And so there is a long working relationship there. So in a sense, the team is very much made up of people that she's worked with before, people that she trusts, and people who bring very, very different energies into the room. And so, Meow Meow is fantastic. And that scene where she's getting into bed with Bottom, when she's taking off her tights.
It was just gorgeous. It's just, you know, the joy of sex or something like that.
Yes, but also the desperation, you know, that sort of, because she is absolutely bewitched, isn't she?
I know, I've never actually seen Bottom and Titania get it on like that, ever. Normally it's just sort of all brushed over, but they go for it in such a wonderful way.
Yes, no, it's but very... And he's wearing that ridiculous vest and white boxer shorts
and
underpants.
And yet, he's quite sexy, even with the acid head on again.
Yes, well, I'm sure he
could go for him.
Delighted to hear that.
Ewan Wardrop.
Yes, that's right. Again,
my best Bottom ever. Oh, that sounds very that's very odd.
It's quite funny getting you get these stage you know, when you have these stage reports at the end of the day. So I get stage reports emailed to me. And last night I was reading them out to my husband. I was saying, listen to this. You don't usually get emails like this. Today, Bottom's Ass's head was a bit wobbly. Can somebody please check it out? Today we will not be bringing on the rollerblading the rollerblading centaur because his left leg is hurting or something.
Sweet.
And then the funniest one I heard was Titania needs more tights.
Well, no heartfelt cry for tights. Yes, so. Let's just talk a bit about some of the changes that you have had to make. One I really noticed was Away, You Ugly Bitch. Well, I looked up the original Ethiop. Of course you couldn't leave that, could you?
No, Ethiop. There's a thing where he says, Away, You Ugly. Did he say ugly?
Ethiop and a few other things.
So we kind of thought, well, I can't do that because that's just racist.
Yeah.
And if we're going to change anything, that's the thing you should change.
Exactly. I mean, it may not have been in Shakespeare's day, but as you've brought it up to the present, it certainly is. Yes.
So we changed it to bitch, which is equally offensive.
Awful. Yes. I mean, when he says, Away, you ugly bitch, I thought, oh.
Well, actually, it's interesting because a lot of the audience you know, was a sharp intake of breath. Ooh. Because even that word bitch is actually really horrible, isn't it?
It is. It's
and
awful.
I suddenly realised that actually we, when I was growing up, we used it all the time. But now it is very sexy. And yet that's what it's about. I mean, in that scene, we're talking about the scene where Lysander rejects Hermia. Mm. He punches her in the stomach. Mm. So it's quite violent. And it's interesting, isn't it? Because actually it's about relationships as well, and about, you kind of do think, oh God, what's that relationship going to be like in the future? I mean, I know he's bewitched at everything, yeah, but still, it says something about, you know, the nature of things between men and women. And the other thing that we did cut, there was the final speech of Oberon when he's blessing the house before he goes. He says, I can't remember the exact line now, actually. It's something about not wanting any disabled children in the house. Yes. So there was a speech at the end by Oberon, just as he's blessing the house as he leaves, where he says, now until the break of day, through this house each fairy stray, to the best bride bed will we, which by us shall blessed be, and the issue there create ever shall be fortunate, so shall all the couples three ever true and loving be, and the blots of nature's hand shall not in their issue stand, never mole, hair lip, nor scar, nor mark prodigious such as are despised in nativity shall upon their children be. So I cut that out because I kind of felt like it was slightly disablest, and I didn't want it to offend people. But also, I know that there are diehards who say you shouldn't change anything of the text to kind of make it PC. But I thought in the character of this production, it was all right. So there were little cuts like that all the way through where we took an informed decision.
Well, obviously, when I was reading through your version, you're going to notice when we've got Jack shall have Jill and Jill shall have Jack, because that's
yes.
You moved that bit. But then Nought shall go in, and then you've got this lovely thing that no looking back, there's no looking back, and on you go, Jill will have Jill, Jack will have Jack, no one will need an aphrodisiac. So I kind of knew that wasn't Shakespeare, but
yes,
I rather loved it.
But that's actually a song that they sing at the end, that Oberon and Titania sing right at the end when she's doing the trapeze. Jack shall have Jill is in the original text.
Yes.
So then I just played around, Jill shall have Jill, Jack shall have Jack.
You had to, didn't you?
Yeah. So, and again, what's great is within a modern audience, with a young audience, you get people just smiling and laughing out of recognition, because that is where we're at the moment in this society. And we're talking about Bankside, and we wanted to reflect, you know, the people that we see on the tube, the fact that we're living in this multicultural London, despite all the madness that's going on in the world, you know, that this is modern Shakespeare, isn't it?
Yeah, certainly is. So we started talking about your songs there, didn't we? So let's go on talking about the wonderful songs, because there's a fair few. And one of the things you do is you pick up, sometimes you move poetry around, and you nick John Donne's lovely poem, Sutton's Mistress Going to Bed, isn't it?
Yes.
And we get the license, My Roving Hands, and let them go. What is it, above, below, before?
Yeah.
Behind, before, between, below, whatever it is.
Yes.
And that
it's very
becomes,
sexy, isn't it?
Oh, well, it's sexy anyway, but
yeah,
extremely
it's
sexy.
With the songs, that was one of the first things that Emma talked to me about, was putting songs in. And but she wanted them from the sonnets. She didn't want me to just make them up. And I said, you've got to be joking. So I went away and I looked at we read all the sonnets, and which I'd never done before. So that was really interesting, yeah. And then talked to Stu Barker, who is the composer on this. Now, Stu is, again, someone that I've worked with before on The Empress, and he's the loveliest man, and also just quietly genius, I think I would say. So he composed all the music in Midsummer Night's Dream, and also composed the music to the songs that I'd written. And we both sat down together with a sonnet. I think one of the ones, Shall I Compare Thee to a Summer's? So that was the first one we looked at, because that's the most obvious. And I said to Stuart, you know, we just said, look, it doesn't fit into a song, because a song has a chorus, and you can't really write a song in 14 lines, I mean, in terms of the actual tune. So that's when I said to Emma, this doesn't work. She went, just change it to Nika. And I went, really? You want me to mess around with the sonnets? And she went, yeah, go on then. So basically that's what I did. I took the essence of the sonnets and then and the first line, basically, and then changed it slightly. Because, of course, a lot of the sonnets are actually about... Your beauty will fade. I love you, but your beauty will live on in my poetry.
Yes, it's pretty
classic. It's just like it doesn't always fit with the actual what we were trying to do in the play. So I think I wrote a lot more songs that actually went in, because otherwise, if they put all my songs in, we would have been there even longer than we already were there. I really wanted Titania to arrive singing a song, particularly as I knew that Meow Meow was doing it, but in the end that got cut because it just was too long, basically. So it's very much an ensemble piece. So the two main songs are when Lysander is trying to persuade Hermia into bed, and that's actually not a sonnet, that's from the John Donne poem. And again, that's taking the opening lines and then messing around with it to fit it into a song. So me and Stu work quite a lot together, and sometimes we'd be sitting there coming up with the most ridiculous words that just so that they would rhyme. But then, of course, it came eventually. And they do work, but I would have loved it if we had more songs in there.
I think I might have as well. We also managed to get in the second most famous sonnet, I guess, or first equal, which is Let Me Not to the Marriage of True Minds Omit Impediment, which works in... they haven't been terribly true, these minds, and now they're going towards being truer. Yes. I think that's why it's there.
Yes, and that was something that I did actually have to change quite a lot, because, again, it was about trying to fit it into the sentiment at the moment.
But that's all fine too. Everyone's picked up on the fact that the production, the song, well, singing at least, there's a lot of amplification, which I didn't feel they needed, to be honest. I thought there were some quite loud voices there, but hey, I didn't really mind. But
To be honest, before working on Midsummer Night's Dream, I have never been to the Globe before. It wasn't ever a place that I felt particularly inclined to go to, and it wasn't very welcoming, I thought. So when I got there and it was all being mic'd up and everything, I just assumed that's how it was done. Yeah. And it was only later on that I realised that it was quite a departure from the way that they usually work there. So, I mean, if you're going to object to the mic'ing up, you can object to absolutely everything in that show, including the lighting and the sound.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And the sort of... sort of jumping in and out of the text, you know, there's quite a lot of the mechanicals making little health and safety
and
notices.
And one of the best modernising, they said, Google it. They want to know if there's moonshine on a particular night. Google it. You would. Yeah. Was that you or them?
Yeah, I think it's them.
it's just so perfect.
Yeah,
I think there
is a lot of departure from the way that they usually work there. So, but... You know, for me, it didn't really necessarily bother me at all. And of course, you do realise that Emma's partner is a sound man, so they work together a lot, and it's all about how it sounds. Mm. I know that her next production that she's doing, I went to see it at the in a rehearsal room the other day, which was The Flying Lovers of
Vitebsk.
And
it's about Chagall and his wife Bella.
Oh my goodness me, that is so beautiful. It's so beautiful. It's only two actors and two musicians, and I think it's going to be in the Sam Wanamaker.
It's going to go to Bristol, very, very different.
And I should imagine nothing like that's been done at the Globe before.
I was just going to say that you've been talking a lot about the music and writing the work. I absolutely adore the wonderful musician who, obviously, Stu himself appears to have been doing an awful lot of it, but Shima Mukherjee plays the sitar and also the clarinet.
Yes, she does.
But mainly the sitar in this.
She's the only musician you can actually see very clearly.
Yes, but totally the whole time.
Yeah,
and she's playing the whole time.
Yes, she's amazing. Amazing woman. And she, again, played in The Empress at the RSC. So, again, someone we've worked with before.
Tight team. Yeah. Well, Before I let you go, back to the rehearsals, just tell me a tiny little bit about Love and Stuff, because I was going to say, what are you doing next? But you're doing it and you're here.
Yes, so Love and Stuff is a play that has been brought back, actually, and that was performed here 2 years ago, and it's just a two-hander, and it's inspired by Stones in Their Pockets by Marie Jones, so it's just basically two actors playing lots and lots of different roles. They play about 20 roles, but it's laugh out loud. I mean, I have spent most of my time in rehearsals just laughing like a drain, which is kind of puts off the actors a bit, I think. And it's going to go on here in a couple of weeks' time.
Yeah, so it'll run from...
3rd of June. For 3 weeks.
Excellent. And yes, if anybody wants to see the amazingness on that stream, which is such a great opening production for Emma's reign at Shakespeare's Globe, they've got till the autumn, actually.
Yes, I think it finishes something like 1st of September, 3rd of September, something like that, but it's selling really quickly. So.
Not at all surprised. people should get on down there. So thank you so much, Tanika Gupta, for talking to me today.
Thank you.
The Theatre Voice, I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much.